Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Scott V. Edwards. He's the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Zoology at Harvard University and Curator of Ornithology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. And J. Michael Reed. He's a professor of biology at Tufts University. And they are the editors of a new book, New Perspectives in Ornithology, 21st Century Dispatches Across the World of Birds. Scott Michael, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Yeah, we're really excited to be here.
I mean, this was a sort of a wild book for me because it's, first of all, it's a big book. It's a dense book. Would you call this a textbook?
No, not at all. It's, as you said yes and I said no. It's something that could be used as a textbook in an advanced class in ornithology, but that's not the only audience.
What would you say?
Yeah, I would agree. It's definitely not a textbook. It's really for someone who wants to get up to speed quickly on the latest and the greatest in the science of ornithology. I am using it for my bird class, which I'm teaching this semester, but I tell the students it's not your typical textbook, so I supplement it with sort of vanilla ice cream type figures that come from textbooks.
I actually saw it as an introduction to ornithology today. That would be a great, and actually I also found a lot of the essays would be of interest to birders.
I think that's correct. And we've had some feedback from people who are not professionals, but they're into birding.
Yeah.
And they said
I'm a hardcore birder.
Yeah, but they found the chapters accessible, which we were pleased by.
Well, I would go beyond that. Not only are they accessible, but there's actually topics discussed that I found really, really interesting. We'll talk about some of those when we get to the general body of the book. I want to talk about putting the book together. And first, let's talk about the Nuttall Ornithology Club. That is an old organization.
Yeah, it really is. It's just one of those U.S. institutions that probably not too many people outside the Boston area know about, but it's just a really great that it's survived all these years. And it's great that this book is able to celebrate that their 150th anniversary.
So this is the oldest professional ornithological organization in the country, and the spinoffs from it for the people who came out of the club started the better known American Ornithologists Union.
As a matter of fact, I was just reading the history of the Nuttall in a larger book about the history of the conservation of birds. And people actually thought that the Nuttall was going to be absorbed into the AOU, but that never happened.
That's interesting, because a lot of the people that were instrumental in founding the Nuttall Club, were also instrumental in founding the AOU,
right,
which is, of course, today called the AOS, the American Ornithological Society. And so people like William Brewster were involved with both, and fortunately, it wasn't absorbed. I think both organizations have their purpose for the birding and science community.
Now, when you put together a book like this, how in hell did you solicit all these papers from all over the world?
Well, the great thing is working with Michael is that I think our expertises are sort of complementary. I'm an evolutionary biologist, whereas Michael is a ecologist and conservation biologist. And so combined, we have a pretty impressive network. And also we did ask some authors that we had never met before because we didn't want to just invite authors that were in our personal networks. We really wanted to have a balanced representation of what's going on in the science of birth today.
You're right about that in the introduction, the preface to this book, this collection of papers. There was a concerted effort to get representation from researchers in Africa and in South America, Europe, and North America, and also a balance of female to male scientists that wrote the papers.
Yeah, and that wasn't an accident, but it also reflects the field.
That's right.
That's right. And, you know, it's actually fascinating because, you know, often people think of science as being, you know, it's not a personal thing, and basically it's this sort of objective thing that falls from the sky. Well, that couldn't be more farther from the truth, because we have good examples in ornithology where, you know, as women got more representation and conducting more studies, we actually learned more about birds, about topics that we didn't know before. And so, for example, you know, understanding when do female birds actually sing like males.
There's a paper about that in this book.
Exactly. And just the whole interactions between the sexes, there are so many dimensions to that that were not discovered by men, and it really took the involvement of women to flesh those out.
And I have to say, I really appreciated the variety of voices expressed in the papers. It was a different kind of collection of ornithology papers than I'm used to. However, it sounds like you didn't get representation from Asia.
Well, that
we tried.
That was a big pause, guys.
Well, we tried.
That's what it said. It sounded like you tried. And what was amazing to me is so much of the really important fossils that have come out in the last couple of decades are from China.
Well, you're absolutely right. We did fortunately have one of our authors was Jingmai O'Connor, who's
right.
Actually going to be speaking at the museum on February 19th. She is of Asian descent, let's put it that way, and she has actually worked at the Institute for Vertebrate Paleontology in Beijing. And so she was our link to all those incredible fossils from China. But you're absolutely right. Ornithology in China is exploding, and it was our shortcoming that we just didn't get more authors from there. Is it
possible that China is not encouraging scientists there to participate in projects from North America?
I don't think we ran into that, did we, Scott?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It's, you know,
I had to ask.
Yeah. No, it's just an oversight, and it's, you know, you're working in 15 different projects, and it was just an oversight on both our parts. There's a lot of exciting science going on in China, and we should have had more of it. But we do have those incredible Chinese fossils, which is great.
Well, I love your introduction to this volume, because there's a lot of interesting parts to it. You write, birds are widely recognized today as being one of the best-known clades of organisms on Earth. Why is I know the answer to this, but I want to hear you two talk about this. Why is that so?
Well, people have been fascinated by birds since they've been able to look up, I suspect. They share so many characteristics with humans. They're out during the day. They rely on colors. They rely on sounds. So they communicate and interact in ways that that humans empathize with. And people have always been fascinated with the idea of flying. So I think it's a very easy tie-in.
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, the truth is birds are incredibly like we humans. You know, they interact in ways like humans. They have social lives. And I think we're just drawn to this other group of organisms that's warm-blooded like us, you know. It's, you know, and plus they're just so visible, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I think the most obvious thing for people who enjoy natural history, and I do, that I'm passionate about reptiles and amphibians, but they're only around in a small time of the year up here in New England.
I agree. I'm always.
I don't care where I am. I can be in downtown Worcester or Boston or New York, and just look up and there's birds.
That's right. I mean, how does someone actually get interested in a serious way in reptiles? Of course, you see snakes occasionally, but they're
Don't knock the herpetology guys.
Well, I know.
That was my brother who.
I think if you're living in the southwestern or the western U.S.,
you have a better chance.
The southwest, you run into a lot more reptiles.
Yeah. My brother, who was an ornithologist at the Smithsonian, originally started out with reptiles and quickly switched to birds.
As an undergrad, I was involved in research on small mammals, and that's part of what drove me to birds. I didn't want to have to catch them to study them.
That's just one of the basic things. I mean, you talk about the inconvenient truth is that many scientists gravitate to birds because they're easy to study.
Well,
and I'm glad one of you wrote that, because that's just the truth.
Yeah, I mean, we're not proud. You know, scientists are just like, you know, they're just people. And, you know, we go for the low-hanging fruit. We're lazy in the same way that lots of folks are lazy. So easy data is always attractive.
It's funny, because I was just reading papers by people who are studying hellbenders. And it just occurred to me, man, that's way more labor-intensive than I would consider, although I'm passionate about hellbenders.
On the other hand, you could be drawn to a species who one of its common names is snot otter.
I know. And, like, I mean, let's face it, they are cool-looking. And like I said, I'm passionate about amphibians. And I started out as a kid about loving snakes and stuff like that. But birds, like I said, no matter where I am, there's birds. Now, on the more serious tip, because they're mobile and because they're everywhere, as you write, birds are indicators of the health of the planet, and I want you to elaborate on that.
Yeah, Michael, go for it.
Well, there are a lot of people who consider birds a bellwether of things that are affecting humans because they can be sensitive to habitat change and pollutants and things like that. But, you know, it's highly species specific. So there are some birds that do really well in human altered landscapes and others that don't. I feel like as an indicator, they tend to be kind of coarse. That by the time the birds are gone, you should have been doing something already rather than, oh, we should start something now.
So don't hesitate if you're thinking about becoming an ornithologist. Just do it.
That's right. Act now.
Act now. What is interesting is you sort of do a little mini history of ornithology in this preface piece. And you take it down to the time of Elliot Cowes, 1842 to 1899, and then up until now. It is amazing what ornithology was like back in the mid-19th century. Can one of you talk about that? I mean, it was a very different science than it is today.
You mean, back in the 1970s, you said?
No, 19th century.
Yes, absolutely, 19th century. Yes, no, it really was. And, you know, honestly, ornithology was born really at the end of a barrel of a gun. Audubon and Wilson, early ornithologists in North America, you know, ornithology was synonymous with taxonomy, essentially. People just needed to know what was out there. And, you know, it's just a very exciting development that it branched out into all these different fields, ecology, behavior. And, you know, that took some time. I think the first step naturally is to figure out what you have. And that's now what we have in museums, like the museum at Harvard University. But, it's much more than that, and it's exciting that we have that represented in the book.
People may find it hard to believe, but
to be fair, the optics were terrible.
You're right.
So people didn't have options, and until Roger Torrey Peterson came along, there wasn't a commonly used field guide that drew people into the area either. But if you want to cite somebody in the previous century, James Bond said when he went out looking at birds, if you didn't shoot them, you didn't know anything.
That's right.
Because you could be mistaken.
And that was the James Bond that became the James Bond.
Well, that's the James Bond, who wrote the Birds of the West Indies, is the one that.
Oh, you're talking about a different. You're talking about a different. You're talking about a different James Bond. Yeah, yeah. The other thing is, people would be surprised how little conservation was on the minds of early ornithologists.
Well, I think, I think there actually was, and it was who was shouting the loudest and who was having the most influence. For example, you know, the Massachusetts Audubon Society was founded, or really was instigated by the work of several women who were drawing attention to the fact that we were using, you know, bird plumes in women's hats, and how this was not going to be a sustainable practice. So they had a very clear vision that the ways we were interacting with birds was not sustainable. And fortunately, eventually, you know, organizations like Mass Audubon and National Audubon eventually sprung up and did something about it.
You're listening
but to be fair,
okay.
In the academic world, it took longer for conservation to catch on in the ornithological communities. I can remember old school people who I won't name who basically said that conservation would get into the journals over their dead body because applied science was inferior science. So there was pushback.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's fair, you know, I think the book reflects sort of both sides. I mean, I'm very much a basic scientist. I'm curious about how birds work and how they evolved. But, you know, I would say Michael probably does a bit more applied science, but also the field of ornithology is today so driven by conservation. I mean, if you look at the American Ornithological Society and the talks at the Nunnell Club, there's a lot of conservation, and that's driven by a sense of urgency, you know? Mm. So we wanted to capture that. It's certainly important, but we also just wanted to have a little time just to enjoy the incredible ways in which birds work. I mean, I think that sort of curiosity can inspire conservation. We really have to understand how birds work in order to love them and conserve them.
You're listening to WNYC.
And the more you know, the more you like them.
That's right.
You're right. You have to know it in order to like it.
That's right. Yeah.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Scott V. Edwards. He is the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Zoology at Harvard University and Curator of Ornithology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. And J. Michael Reed. He's a professor of biology at Tufts University, and they are the editors of a new book that is really interesting to read, New Perspectives in Ornithology, 21st Century Dispatches Across the World of Birds. One of the other things, and this is brought up in a whole section in your book, is the advances in monitoring technology have really allowed ornithologists to track birds and bird behavior like no other time before.
Absolutely.
It's mind-boggling. The devices keep getting smaller and smaller, so you can put them on smaller birds. Their capacity to store data is skyrocketing. Some of these are linked to satellites, so you can track movement on a constant basis.
Go ahead.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I use a lot of genetics in my work, and so a lot of my work takes place in the lab, and I often wonder, in many ways, ecology and just keeping track of where birds are is so much more challenging than lab-based stuff. And the fact it's really the holy grail of ecology is to know where birds are and when and they're occurring in certain places. And that simple task is finally being tackled by some of the technology being brought to bear.
Now, there are five overarching sections in the book. One is ecology, evolution, behavior, databases and citizen science, and conservation management. Was there anything you had to leave out just for brevity's sake?
So we weren't really that concerned about brevity.
I understand.
I would say that a couple things got left out because we either couldn't find someone to write the paper or they agreed to write it and then didn't write it. So it could have been longer.
Yeah. Another way in which scientists are mere mortals is they sometimes just drop the ball.
Well, there's a lot of folks who overcommit because they're good people and they're interested, but you can't always deliver.
You would have liked to have included papers on sexual selection, urban ecology, which I would have been very interested in, physiology and neuroscience. But that sounds like that's enough for another whole volume.
It really is. I mean, there's so many dimensions to ornithology. I think the book ended up erring on the side of let's think about birds in their natural environment. I think as opposed to, for example, how their brains work or that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Both are interesting, but we kind of tended to leave out a lot of the more stuff happening on the insides of birds.
There's some interesting parts of several of these papers that I just want to have you talk about. What I found interesting in the paper Speciation and Adaptation in Birds by, I think it's Toews, is it pronounced?
And David Toews, yeah.
Toews, okay. I love the fact that at the end, on page 182, he says, It's a whole thing about technology and how great it is. But then he says, technology is not the silver bullet and will not replace the hard, muddy work of natural history. And I found that interesting. And do you agree with him?
Absolutely. And just to go into Scott's field for a moment, now that we can sequence genomes, we can find minute differences across a landscape. But we don't necessarily know how meaningful they are to the individual.
That's right. And one of the interesting things about David's chapter on speciation is that he studies these wood warblers, the Parulidae, which everyone loves to see when they migrate up north to the Boston area. But, you know, some of the species that look very, very different to us, if you look at their DNA, they're almost identical. And they only differ from each other in a few very specific places in their DNA on their chromosomes. And that's the story that David really brings to life in his chapter. And it's absolutely fascinating.
I mean, a favorite quote from him is, binoculars will always be needed.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it. Now, there's a sentence in one of the papers, and maybe you don't want to comment on this, but it was like less than universally admired roguishness that had been documented in the works of Sibley and Ahlquist.
What? Oh my gosh.
Now, what was that about? Because actually, my brother was at the meeting where Sibley and Ahlquist pasted up all the new taxonomy all over the walls. So what's this roguishness?
Mark, who is your brother, Mark?
Dr. James Lynch. Unfortunately, he's passed away. He did a lot of work on habitat fragmentation.
Okay,
sure.
He was with the Smithsonian.
Okay,
I know that. I know that work.
Yeah.
So, what's this idea of roguishness?
Well, that's probably getting into some sort of private jokes that I'm not sure everyone wants to read about. But
I do.
Look, Charles Sibley was. He did a lot of important work using DNA to understand the phylogeny and family trees of birds, but he was also kind of a mean guy. I had been on the end of his jibes, and you know,
so polarizing.
He's not with us anymore. So, he left his legacy great, but let's move on. Let's make science more inclusive and fun, frankly.
You did a great job of being very politic about the way you described that.
Well, like any field, there are personalities, and times change in how people behave, and there's,
okay. And enough said.
Any field that it isn't true.
You're absolutely right. We only have a few minutes left, and I just wonder if you could just say one or two sentences about why the fossils in China have been so game-changing.
I encourage folks, I don't know when this is going to be aired, but on the 19th, Jingmai O'Connor will be here at the museum to tell folks about that. It's really one of the most exciting stories of 20th and 21st century ornithology. Part of it is just that Chinese scientists and paleontologists have been enabled and they've been supported financially through their governments.
Right.
I think China recognized that their fossil history is a point of national pride. And it's remarkable, the story and the details. The first feathered dinosaurs,
right.
The first birds with specific traits for modern birds. And it's just a really fascinating story, and I was just so delighted when Jingmai did an amazing job.
I'm impressed by the quality of the fossils. The fossils are amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you can see the feather impressions of these birds that are kind of halfway between Archaeopteryx and modern birds.
And yeah.
It's just extraordinary. And it's one of the best known transitions we know of in the vertebrate fossil record. It's really extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I also love the fact that there is a paper in here included about chickens. I'm being serious. I'm not being a wise guy. I thought that was a really interesting, and you sort of forget chickens are birds.
Well, I'll tell you how that came about was we were looking for researchers in Africa, and this author we contacted and said, we'd like you to write about what you think is important about conservation.
And absolutely is. I think it's an exemplary paper that came out of left field and then made me realize, there's a broader aspect here of ornithology that I didn't think of.
And it surprised us too and put us back. We were like, wow, well, we wouldn't have thought of asking for a chapter on
we
were pleasantly surprised.
We're completely out of time. My guests tonight are Scott V. Edwards. He's the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Zoology at Harvard University and Curator of Ornithology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. And J. Michael Reed, he's the Professor of Biology at Tufts University, and together they edited this amazing collection of papers. New Perspectives in Ornithology, 21st Century Dispatches Across the World of Birds. Scott and Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate the time. Only 300 shopping days till Christmas.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Bye-bye.